Hello, and welcome to my podcast, John Scott Lawton's English You Know. In today's episode, I'm interviewing Sonia Ross, a voice, speech and pronunciation coach. Since 2006, when she completed her Master of Arts in Voice Studies, she's helped thousands of international professionals express their valuable ideas clearly, smoothly, confidently and authentically in business and in life. She's based between London and Hastings in the United Kingdom, and she works globally online, supporting individuals to develop and to use their own unique voice, their own instrument. In this podcast description, I've also included website links to Sonia's website, a free PDF, a link in there, which is free resources, which give 10 top tips about how to develop excellent pronunciation skills in English. We talk about that on the podcast. I've also included Sonia's LinkedIn link so that you can contact her and make contact if you wish, and also her Instagram page. We hope you really enjoy the podcast, and we welcome any comments you might like to make, either through the Spotify Sound app or through emailing me, johnscottlawton@hotmail.co.uk. Again, the link is in the podcast description. Thank you very much indeed.
Hello, Sonia. Thank you very much for joining me on the podcast. Delighted to see you. I can see you at least via video. Obviously, we're just going for audio here. Tell me a little bit about yourself and what brought you into the line of work that we're going to talk about today.
Thank you, John, and thank you for having me. Well, how I got into my line of work, I'm a voice, speech and pronunciation coach. So I work with a speaking voice. I help people express their ideas clearly, confidently, and with impact. And I've been doing what I do for 16, 17 years now, really in different guises with different emphases at different times. But I come from a language teaching background. My first degree was in English language and linguistics. I taught English as a foreign language for a few years, and then I did a master's in voice studies, which enabled me to do what I do now.
And have you ever done any acting, or have you applied your voice in a way other than in teaching English?
Not really, no. My master's degree took place at a drama school. So I was alongside a lot of people who were ex-actors, but I'm definitely not an actor myself. I've done a few acting classes for fun. I've worked in the context. I have, in fact, worked in drama schools. I've taught phonetics and accents there. This is a few years ago now. But no, I'm not an actor myself. And that's part of the reason why I don't really work in the theatre world today.
Interesting. So tell me, typically, the kinds of students, or kind of, are they students, are they clients, people you work with, what are their backgrounds and why do they come to you for support?
Well, there's a whole range of reasons, really. Business people, they're professionals, they're people who come from a whole range of professional backgrounds. I've worked with, for example, academics, financial professionals, people who are entrepreneurs. I do sometimes still work with actors, but it's definitely not the majority of my work. So there's a whole range of professional backgrounds, but what tends to bring people to me is that they feel there's something in their speaking voice, because it's only speaking voice I work with, definitely not a singing teacher, that there's something in their speaking voice that's holding them back. So they might feel that they're not getting their message across clearly enough. Maybe they are asked to repeat themselves more often than they'd like. Maybe English is not their first language, although very often it is. So whether it is or it isn't, some people want to work on getting heard better. We might be working on the audibility of the voice, what people used to call projection, actually. And yeah, there is some pronunciation work as well for people who don't have English as a first language, but also I work on clarity with people who are first language English speakers as well. So there is a whole range of needs, but I think we can summarize it by people who want to unlock something in their speaking voice to communicate more clearly and effectively. Mm-hmm.
Is there something about the power of the voice? Because sometimes a quiet voice can be used powerfully if it's used well. But at other times, particularly in a very competitive meeting, let's say for business people, you need to be heard, but you need to be heard in a way that doesn't appear too dominating or domineering or too controlling, or certainly not shouting, because people will think you're angry. So what kind of techniques do you use to help people get their point across when perhaps normally they would have a quieter voice than some?
Okay, so I think there are two things in there. Firstly, my first answer is it's all about choice. So it definitely isn't about being as loud as you possibly can be, because there are certain situations in which that isn't particularly effective or appropriate. We want to get heard, but we don't want to push people away with our voices. Of course not. And you're absolutely right that sometimes talking a little bit more quietly is more effective. So the first thing is I want to equip people with choice. And that's actually why I call myself Vocal Choice. That's what I want to equip people with. It's not about saying that a particular type of voice is better or worse. And we're never about slapping an ideal voice on top of people. But it's about bringing out all the abilities, the facets, the frequencies of the voice that's naturally inside somebody that might be hiding behind habits, which I think leads me to the second response I have to your question, is the actual techniques that we work on freeing up the voice. And that could be, first of all, looking at how somebody's using their body, how you're sitting, how you're standing, how you're breathing, especially if there are any tensions in the body that might be restricting the breath or the flow of the voice through the body, which may have been feeling completely normal to that person for years, but we're unlocking other possibilities that were already there. So that, let's say, a voice that is more audible or even cut through background noise better, can get heard more easily, more clearly, is accessible, and it then becomes part of that person's repertoire when maybe it wasn't there before.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. I sometimes describe myself as having two volumes. This normal volume now, which is actually a little quiet, but it feels comfortable to me. It feels easier. And there's a reason for that we might talk about later. But then I've also got what I call a shouty voice. My children would say, I've got a very shouty voice, which was trained at football matches or playing football, and it's very loud. And it's so I either have a quiet volume or a very loud volume. Not much in between until I learned to sing, in which case I then gave my voice more flexibility, more adaptability within the range. But originally I had a quiet voice and a very loud voice.
Indeed. And that's filling in the range in between. It sounds like that's been very useful for you. And it is all about being adaptable and flexible. I think very often people say, I have a quiet voice, or I'm a mumbler, or I have a squeaky voice, or I have a low voice, and whatever that means. And that's true. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with any of those things. But if we're limited to only that thing or that set of habits, then we might find that causes challenges maybe in the workplace or everyday life. So not that I'm saying that it does for you, but I'm saying just in general, that's what tends to bring a lot of people to me.
Yes.
Yes.
Is it true that your voice is as different as a fingerprint, almost, that we can recognize? This is where voice recognition technology comes in, but it's used a lot now even by banks when you're accessing your bank account. Is it true that it is as unique as any other part of your DNA, your voice?
I think so, because we all have unique configurations. I mean, all of us have the same speaking equipment. We've got our vocal cords, we've got our lips, the tongue, etc., the jaw, all of the things that move, the breathing system that come together to create the voice. But when the vibrations of the voice are created, they've got to pass through cavities like the throat, the mouth, to an extent, the nose. And depending on our own unique shape and size, those vibrations can they do sound unique because they're passing through these uniquely shaped cavities. Now, voice work sometimes works on opening up those cavities and creating freedom in them, which can make the voice of that individual sound a bit different, maybe a bit richer, a bit fuller. But ultimately, yes, it is still the person's unique voice.
And how important, you mentioned it first, how important is breath work, breathing correctly and connected therefore with posture, how we sit or how we stand? How do you start working on that? What kind of techniques do you use with people?
Well, firstly, it's very important. I often start working on breath without working directly on breath. So if we work on the posture, or I often use the word alignment because it sounds a bit less about correctness and rigidity, because it's never about rigidity. It's about freedom. We want the breath to be free for the voice to be free. So if we're sitting, sometimes I would ask somebody to make sure that their feet are firmly on the floor, that they're sitting in quite a symmetrical way. This has nothing to do with how it looks or image making. I mean, and other types of coaching might focus on that, but I don't really. But what we're focusing on is creating a physical environment so that the breath and the voice can flow through us freely.
Yes.
And if we end up, if the person ends up feeling that their voice, experiencing their voice is easier or less effort, usually then we know we're on the right track. But sometimes it really helps just to work on posture, aligning the spine, allowing the spine to be long, and it just tends to give us that the vocal tract, the let's say the open passage for the voice. It tends to give it more freedom. Sometimes that already makes a difference in itself, but then usually once we've done that, we can work more directly on breath. Sometimes people find that they are just breathing quite shallowly because the lower part of the torso, that some muscles around the abdomen are quite tense and not allowing any movement in the lower body, because we want I think most people have heard of the diaphragm, which is that sheet of muscle underneath the lungs, and we want there to be some enough freedom in the lower part of the body for that diaphragm to be able to move so that breath can be fuller and more likely to support the voice. Because if the breath is not supporting the voice, then we run out of breath, our voice runs out of steam, and
Yes.
then we might end up rushing to fit those words into the little breath that we have. So various practical techniques. It really depends on the individual. Very often we're sitting in a chair. I get the person to put their hand on their stomach, hand on their chest, see how they feel, what they feel, what's moving underneath the hand. Sometimes I use images. So we might, of course, we're not directly breathing into the belly. There's no air going into the actual stomach. But because we do find some flexibility and movement in that area, we can imagine that the air is going in there. And sometimes that can create a good result. And another thing I do, I often send people away with an audio recording so that they can practice breath by themselves. And yeah.
Very good. And when people are giving presentations, do you go with the standard advice that you should really, if you can, stand up rather than sit down? Does that really make a difference?
I think that there can be a bit more freedom standing up. So I usually ask the person if they do tend to present standing up. I'm not going to tell them to change what they normally do because, usually it could be the venue or just their circumstances is going to dictate that anyway. But if the person does know that they're going to have to present standing, then we do work standing a lot. You can get more freedom definitely while standing. But sometimes accessing that freedom, it depends on the person, but it could end up being easier, but it could end up being more challenging. Because something that's really important in voice work, we use the word support a lot. It's not just that the breath supports the voice, it's that the whole body framework supports the breath. And then whatever we're on, the floor or the chair, supports the body framework. So it all comes down to that. And if you are standing, it's only your feet that are touching the floor. That's quite a small surface area. So that can sometimes be a bit more challenging to get our support, and our grounding is what I call grounding. But we definitely do work on that if that's a situation that a person is going to be presenting in. And honestly, for most people, we work sitting and standing at some point, usually.
Yes. It's interesting how important the feet are. The feet, as you said, are planted, they're grounded. When I did media training, I was always told, plant your feet very heavily, give yourself a solid foundation with the ground, and this will affect your confidence. It will affect your posture and how tall you're standing, but it will also affect, therefore, eventually your breath, because it will move not up from the feet, but you will feel, as you said, a stronger frame, more in contact. But I used to often move around when I was giving presentations, and I realized after a while it was affecting the quality of my speech. So particularly when I was making an important point, I would always make sure I was standing still. And then, rather like people can't see it as I'm doing now, I'm moving my hands. I watched a TED talk the other day that said people who gesticulate, who use their hands a lot in presentations, are trusted more by the listeners. It's a very interesting dynamic in research that the use of the hands is actually very important. It's not affecting here the speech, but it's affecting the message.
Yeah, I think coming back to what you said about the advice you were given to plant your feet on the floor while presenting, absolutely, it can make us feel more confident. And I think on some level, even if we consciously know it or not, the feeling that the voice is coming through us freely can contribute to our feeling confident, and also even coming across as confident. Because even if we as listeners know nothing about voice work, we do tend to hear a free and open voice as a sign that that person is feeling confident and relaxed. Rather than if we hear, let's say, if a voice is restricted at all, that we might be able to tell that that person is a bit tense and not quite present in the moment.
Mm-hmm. It's almost psychological as well, isn't it? People begin to distrust the message. And if you're not particularly confident about what you're going to say or how you're going to say it, that again comes across, I think, in your voice.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yes. Because if we again come back to the physical, which you'll have guessed by now is something they do a lot, if we are hesitating, if we are not confident about what we're saying, what's likely to happen in the body is again tension, blockage, maybe holding the breath, etc. So it's about making people aware of these habits which they may not have noticed before.
Mm-hmm. And do you video people as well when perhaps they're training or preparing for a presentation? Do you find that would help?
Absolutely, sometimes, yes, but not in the early stages. So this is also an important thing. At the very early stages, especially if voice work is new to somebody, I'd much prefer that they experience the changes or their progress through how the voice feels rather than capturing it on a recording. Recordings can be super useful. They're really useful for pronunciation work, which I think we'll talk about later. But in terms of vocal freedom, accessing your full vocal tone, recordings can be really useful. But in the early stages, I'd prefer that somebody feels the freedom of their voice, the vibrations of their voice internally. Just because I think if we hear a recording that happens to be quite good, I think the risk is that that person then strives towards getting that actual tone.
Mm-hmm.
And that can create tensions in itself when there's a phrase, the end gaining, mm-hmm. which is like you're trying to gain a particular result. And of course, we are trying to gain a particular result, but we're not striving towards a particular tone. So I think that that can be an inherent risk. That's how I see it anyway, but recording that's at the right stage can definitely be useful, of course.
Thinking about the tone of voice, there's this famous story that Margaret Thatcher, former British Prime Minister, of course, when she first started out in politics, had a very high-pitched tone, and some people found it, if not irritating to listen to, it wasn't as convincing, people thought. She was then advised to lower the tone of her voice. Is that something you work on as well, the tone of the voice?
Well, again, this comes back to the freedom of the voice. So we are never about imposing an ideal voice. However, what the one of the most common results on working on the voice is that the we experience the voice and then other people hear it as richer, fuller, which you could describe as lower because it's got more body about it. It's more connected to the body. That's really important. So, you know, right now, if I'm talking and I'm, you know, I start to disconnect my voice a little bit from the body, my voice is sounding a bit higher because I've got a bit more constriction. I won't continue like that for too long because I don't want to give myself a sore throat. But I hope that it's coming across on the recording. If I connect back to my body, which means opening the throat, relaxing a little bit, there's a fullness to my voice that could be interpreted as lower. But we are not technically lowering voices as in changing the natural pitch of the voice as in doing this. No, but I think, look, I don't know exactly what happened in Margaret Thatcher's training, but what I do hear in the result is that there might have been a bit of artificial lowering. And I think there's a lowering of the larynx, which is a bit artificial as well. Which my concern today, I wouldn't encourage somebody to do this because I think if you try to sustain it, you could end up creating other tensions. But again, I don't know the ins and outs of how she was trained. That I'm just speculating based on what I heard.
Yes, interesting. We mentioned psychology. I think when people are stressed and they're nervous, and obviously giving a presentation or being in an interview, they're perfect circumstances to be stressed or to be nervous. And that can affect the voice, can't it?
Absolutely. And this is one of the major reasons why people come to me, is that they may feel absolutely fine when they're relaxed with friends and family. But when they're nervous, especially in work-related, high-pressure situations, then... yeah, it's harder. It is harder. So this is what we work towards. It's harder to access the new choices. Let's say maybe it's very easy to experience a freer voice in what I hope is the non-threatening environment of the training session. But then to bring it into the meeting, the presentation, is more challenging. So one of the first things I say to people is don't save it up just for the high pressure situation, because it will be a lot harder to access when you're actually there. I really encourage people to practice when it doesn't matter so much.
Yep.
Even when you're buying coffee, even when you're chatting to colleague, friend, whatever. Of course, there are certain situations that might feel more or less comfortable for people to practice, but I definitely encourage people to practice when it doesn't matter so that they're creating the muscle memory so that it's more likely to be accessible when it matters more and when it's scarier and when the old habits, the tensions are more likely to come back. It's easy for me to say this. It isn't always so easy to do. But the other thing I do encourage people to do is have a quick way, a short way, a way that doesn't take up too much mental bandwidth of accessing the work. So it might even be as simple as plant the feet on the floor. And that tends to start off a chain of... Okay, so the second thing that I normally encourage people to do is to have an easy way in. And that could be as simple as just one physical shift, which might be placing the feet on the floor. Because when we're nervous, you know, we might be foot tapping, or one foot comes up, or one thigh or side of us comes away from the chair. So just accessing grounding, which is a really quick and simple thing to do. And it might not just be grounding that changes. It might set in a chain of events. It might allow us to allow the person to re-access the freer breath and the open voice. It gives the person a better chance of doing that when in a higher pressure situation. And it's also worth mentioning that the physical reactions we have, the nerves, let's say, of course, it's the nervous system, it's the fight flight response, might kick in these situations. These are often the reasons that the person is bringing themselves to voice training in the first place. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. These reactions are the things that are affecting the voice. Of course, there are other types of coaching may look at the psychology, the reasoning, the mindset behind this. What I'm looking at is the physicality. I'm not saying that necessarily we can stop ourselves feeling nervous, but what we can do is learn to manage or mitigate the physical effects of those nerves. That's the idea, anyway.
Yes. As a language teacher, I mean, I touch on these topics not as an expert. I don't like the word expert really anyway, but because through experience, you know, I've learned that having a glass of water available when you're going to speak, or some kind of hydration, is very useful. Warm water, you know, room temperature rather than cold, because these factors can also affect your voice, can't they? If you're dry, if your mouth is dry, or if you're nervous, or I have a physical problem with my throat that I was strangled when I was younger with a motorbike chain very dangerously, and that crushed my voice box. So that, you know, that gave me a real problem physiologically that I had to overcome through speech therapy. I couldn't speak for a year, so I had to recover my voice. And I know when I'm tired, my voice gets weaker, because the physical act of having to speak for me, even though I'm a language teacher, is actually quite demanding.
Well, first of all, I'm sorry that happened to you. And yeah, it sounds like it would have been quite challenging to get your voice back on track. And you're absolutely right that knowing our own voices, definitely hydration is always good. Although I would say that with the caveat that the bottle of water or the cup of tea can sometimes be a crutch. Mm-hmm. So if we're turning to it all the time, it can affect our presence a little bit. But, you know, everybody's a bit different with that. But yes, being aware of the environment in the room, the air conditioning, the heating, this also connects a little bit to being in the room, taking up space. Because I think when we're feeling a bit nervous, we sometimes just exist in our nervous little bubble there in the corner of the room, and we forget to take in the environment around us. Mm-hmm. So being there, feeling, what is the temperature? What do I need? Knowing what your voice is likely to do. So all of these things, making sure that you have them with you. Yeah, of course, this is always a good idea.
Yep.
But yeah, I'm sorry, have I gone off track a little bit? But
no, that's fine. That's very relevant. I mean,
yeah.
I always advise that if people are going to give a presentation, that they know, or they find out if they can, the actual room they're going to be in where they're going to do it. Because you can become familiar with the acoustics of the room, the size of the room, bearing in mind that when people are in it, the acoustics will be different. How soft the room is, you know, in terms of its fabrics, and does the room echo, things like that. These all help that when you get on stage and you're about to speak, or you're in front of your PowerPoint with an intense audience, that you're ready for almost anything. There will always be some surprise. Just be ready for the surprise, you know, be excited. But that's another thing. When you're excited, a bit like now, when I get carried away with a topic, I tend to speak too quickly. So what do you do with people about the speed at which they're delivering their voice?
Well, again, this is a bit like the louder or quieter. Fast is not necessarily bad, but it's about having choice.
Yeah.
So there are a few ways that I do work on pace. If somebody finds that they do tend to rush when they speak, to the extent that maybe makes the speech less clear, which definitely wasn't happening in your voice there, We may work on a few different techniques. We can work physically, we can work on rhythm. One thing that definitely doesn't work is try to remember to slow down, which we just forget.
No.
No.
Speed up if anything, yeah.
Exactly. So yeah, that gets forgotten easily. But this may be leading into one of the tips that I do share with people wanting to work on pronunciation, clear speech. So something that does help to slow us down is making sure that we optimize the space in the mouth. If somebody is habitually holding their mouth in quite a, let's say, tense position so that there's not much space inside the mouth, we would know that if the upper and lower teeth are being held quite close together.
Yes.
Usually that might be related to a bit of jaw tension, which is something that we often work on. I would encourage the person just to relax the jaw, open up a little bit more, certainly not in an exaggerated way, nothing that looks ridiculous, but just enough so that it might feel a little bit different from normal. And speaking through bigger space quite literally slows us down, because let's say your tongue is reaching to articulate a D or an N or something. A couple of millimeters further away is a fraction of a second longer, and the overall effect is that we do slow down a bit and that the articulation of different sounds is a bit more distinct. So that is a bit funny to talk about it, but that's very often one of the first things I do with people if pace and or clarity is an issue.
Yes.
And another thing that can help with pace is getting people aware of rhythm, even just making them aware of the fact that we can divide our speech into chunks, that we do divide our speech into chunks. This is absolutely not unique to English. It happens in many languages, but sometimes we forget to do that. I'm trying to make it very obvious in my speech right
yes.
now. I'm
yes.
delivering little chunks, but if I was to get a bit overexcited, I might forget to do chunks and then I end up doing the train and talking really quickly like this. It was a bit of an exaggeration, but that can happen to any of us when we are really excited and or nervous about getting our point across. So awareness of chunking and then playing around a little bit with emphasis within those chunks, it can really provide some signposts to the speech so that they know that they've got a bit of anchoring to hold on to, but it also delivers the information to the listeners in a bit more of a bite-sized way so that they get easier to follow. And again, the overall effect is that people tend to slow down.
Yes. And when you're emphasized just like there, you're going to emphasize a really important point. It's not that you stop, but you slow down almost to a stop. I can't remember the speed of that on a train, but it's very slow or dead slow on a boat. And then you deliver the punch. You deliver the final point you really want to make. And that can be very dramatic, but it can be very useful for the voice as well.
Yeah, exactly. We often do pause before a big emphasis. And yes, absolutely. So we're giving ourselves sometimes quite literally a chance to take a breath, because the pauses are our chance to breathe. We might not need to breathe in every single pause we make, but there are opportunities to do so if we need to. So yes, a pause can be very effective in quite literally getting our breath back so that we've got fuel for that emphasis that is coming, for sure. And then again, coming back to the grounding and the breath, when your voice is a bit more embodied, that tends to lend itself to a bit more of a measured pace as well.
Interesting. Let's come now to your worksheet, which I know shortly you're going to produce a video on as well, which would be really helpful, but the worksheet is excellent. You've called it 10 expert tips for clear English pronunciation. I always have to say pronunciation. People want to say pronunciation. No, the verb is to pronounce, but the noun is pronunciation. And you say, whatever your accent, which we'll speak about in a minute, whatever your language, you've got top 10 tips, which are great. We'll go through just a few today. Can you start with the one you've already mentioned, the opening up the mouth to make a bigger space, which is then connected not just opening your mouth, but also using your lips more effectively by moving them. So can you talk us through those two?
Yeah, so the opening up the mouth, again, we never want it to be exaggerated, but I'd usually encourage people to become aware of how they are holding their mouth in resting position, because that often informs how we speak. How we start informs how we continue. So again, as I mentioned before, the space between the upper and lower teeth, if you find that you're holding your lower teeth quite close to the upper teeth, it might mean that the jaw is a little bit tense. So we can gently work on that. I mean, look, most people have a bit of extra tension in the jaw. This is perfectly normal. We're not working on completely eradicating it, but we are working to recognize it when it's there so that we can make another choice when it matters. So we might work on that by chewing imaginary gum just to start to open up the mouth a little bit. And often I give people images, like imagine that there's a small spring between your teeth, between your back teeth. Sometimes, depending on the person, I ask them to imagine it between their front teeth as well. That tends to work quite well if people have a particularly small space. And the reason that I use the image of springs is because springs are flexible. This is certainly not about rigidity. But this does tend to work quite well for clarity in English anyway. But, you know, some people say that it helps with clarity in their language too. But that, you know, that's not for me to say. And that's how we work on that. We quite literally open up. If we're going a bit more deeply, we might massage the jaw joint. The masseter muscle is that the muscle that's basically the suspender for the lower jaw, mm-hmm. covers the jaw joint. It is literally the strongest muscle in the body. I'm not sure how they measure that.
Interesting. Yeah.
Because we use it to bite and chew and everything, and it because it's so strong, it likes to take on tensions that are not really its business. So it's definitely worth reflecting on, and that can get worse when we're feeling nervous as well. So we work on that, and as we go deeper, this is more of them working one-to-one with somebody for a bit longer. We may do some exercises on the tongue, because the tongue is just a collection of muscles. And like any other, these muscles can take on their own tensions and habits as well. Mm-hmm. So we sometimes do some stretching, massaging exercises, which might sound a bit scary, but doesn't involve sticking your fingers in your mouth. And what else? Yeah, related to that is the movement of the lips. Something that I often say to people is, imagine that your listeners have to read your lips.
Yes.
Sometimes they might, and you don't know it, so you'll be helping them anyway. But this can encourage you to move your lips more so that you're making your articulation a bit more precise. And I usually do introduce that alongside the opening up of the mouth. Again, it really depends on the individual. Mm-hmm. We tend to start by doing a really exaggerated 100% effort of moving the lips. And then that, of course, is ridiculous. We don't Yes. want 100% effort. We don't want to be exaggerated. But we normally end up at about 60, 70% effort of this imaginary scale. And if the person previously had not been moving their lips very much, it can really bring more clarity, but also a bit more life and dynamism into their speech. It can make them sound a bit more enthusiastic sometimes.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, sorry, go ahead.
Just no, it's a bit like fine tuning, isn't it? It's the very fine movements that you can gain with the lips can be very useful in almost mm-hmm. finishing off words, you know, giving them a bit more color, as you say, a bit more texture.
Absolutely. And I was going to say something there. I've actually forgotten what I was about to say.
Sorry to stop you there. Interesting how people don't realize that our upper jaw stays still, and it's our yes. bottom jaw that's doing all the work. It's moving. Yeah. So when I worked in the drama school, I would often have drama students walking towards me, dropping their lower jaw. And I thought they were going to speak to me. You could see this very exaggerated dropping of the jaw, but they were practicing before they went in the studio for long speech or voice sessions. So it's a good way to, as you say, massage, relax, move the jaw so that it's ready for speech as and when you need it.
Exactly. And I think that it is important to say it's not about opening the jaw again as much as it can go. There might be a bit of that in the exercises, like imagining chewing something big. But of course, what we want to end up with is a relaxed jaw, and that can accommodate that optimized space in the mouth. And I've just remembered the thing I was going to say. Having a bit more space in the mouth and moving the lips a bit more, it can tend to lend itself to more variety of intonation as well. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the color that can then go into the speech. So,
yes. I always use the example of Freddie Mercury and his extra teeth. You know, I ask people, who's one of your favorite singers? And Freddie Mercury's name is often mentioned. And I explain that, you know, he had a big mouth, and his big mouth he used to very great effect. Those extra teeth really did give him that chamber and that flexibility again of being able to produce not only different octaves, but a superb range and color and texture and flavor within his voice. You know, it's very rich.
That makes a lot of sense as to why his voice sounds so cavernous. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Whereas mine, I've got an overbite and it's quite the opposite. So, but I do sing. Singing really does help because it frees up, I think, some of the muscles. Certainly helped me recover my voice. So let's look at another tip, focusing on keywords. This is getting quite technical now, but focusing on the content words within a sentence. You'd need to explain this for us, if you would, Sonia, and how this works for the voice.
So a content word is a word that carries meaning by itself. So it could be a verb, to work, to go, could be a noun, car, shop. They're words that mean something by themselves, as opposed to function words, which are the little words, the prepositions, the articles, maybe pronouns, which they're there for, let's say, grammatical reasons, but of course they are less important to the core meaning of the phrase, which you know yourself. So the little words, the function words, we don't have to pay so much attention to how carefully we pronounce them. We want to focus on or put more stress on the content words, those nouns, verbs, to an extent, maybe adjectives and adverbs, but that's a kind of another story. So if we take the example, I have to finish some work before the meeting, the content words are have, finish, work, and meeting. And these are the words that we have to take particular care over. These are the words in which the space in the mouth and the lip movement really matters, particularly the vowels in these words, or particularly, this is getting into another area, but the vowels within the stressed syllables of these words, the articulation of those vowels really matters because the stress is carried within the vowel on these content words. I have to finish some work before, sorry, I'm doing this a little bit artificially. Let me do it again. I have to finish some work before the meeting. Mm-hmm. You may hear, of course, that there's a bit of an extra emphasis on meeting, which is another story. We're adding intonation in there rather than just stress. But stress is when our voice is more intense, a bit louder, and we are taking particular care of how we are shaping that word. Yes. And that can give our listeners something to hang on to.
The phonetics of getting into vowel sounds is really critical, and it's something I know some students of mine are a little bit resistant to. They don't always want to do much. We'll talk about accent reduction in a minute, but the vowel sound in English, I think, as in any language, is so critical to understanding what has been said And then, especially when you add on this other element you just mentioned, that it carries the stress within a word, and that word carries the stress within a sentence, it's really important that we connect all those dots and get the delivery of those vowels to be as correct as we can be, really.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And of course, vowel sounds, I agree with you, they are important. They do tend to be the star of the show in how many English words are pronounced. So this is actually leading on to the next tip that I often do focus on, which is stressing the correct syllable in longer words. So if we take a word like develop, which has three syllables, develop, we can hear that my stress is on the second syllable, the middle syllable, but that's really carried in the vowel e. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe that particular vowel is not that challenging for speakers of many languages, actually, but we might be dealing with other words where the pronunciation of the vowels does need to be looked at a little bit more precisely. But the difficulty there is, I think with vowel sounds, some people can argue that there is more flexibility in vowel sounds than there is in consonant sounds. Mm-hmm. Because vowels are one of the main things that vary between accents. Mm-hmm. So then how do we choose which vowel quality that we're aiming for? Because yes, by definition, we have to choose then an accent. And not always, but yeah, I think that this is a really, really important point. We do need in pronunciation work, we need a framework to follow, or the learner needs a framework, because otherwise it just isn't useful. If I'm working on, you know, let's say I speak French as a second language, and if I'm working on pronunciation, I don't really want somebody to say, well, in the north it's like this, in the south it's like this, in this region it's like this. This is all interesting information, but it doesn't necessarily help me. And this is how a lot of my clients feel, is that they want guidance and they want framework. However, then which framework to choose is sometimes a bit of a sticky question, because very often we do default to the accent that might be more prevalent in the southeast of England, because the phonetic symbols in the published dictionaries do tend to follow that model. Now, I'm in the southeast of England, many of my clients are, so why not choose that model? But in theory, that could be any model. It could be any accent. And we talk about this at the beginning. There are some things that are just English. So if we want to get clear on, let's say, a consonant sound or the difference between the N and the NG, I know that can vary in different accents, but or that working on the TH sound, again, there can be variety within accents, of course, but there's more of a consensus, I think, among consonants on the whole across the English-speaking world than there is about vowels. So we've always got that moment where there's a choice. Are you going to pronounce the R in car, or are you not? Car, because already that's an accent choice. For clarity, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Actually, but what tends to come up is that people want consistency, and that case then they do have to make a choice, an informed choice, and it's part of my job as a coach to give them the information about that. And yeah, we just always check in, and I might say that increasingly people are interested in clarity. They're not particularly interested in working towards a particular accent, which is understandable, because the English is used as the language of business and travel around the world. Of course, it's going to have huge variety, so it doesn't lend itself to having standards imposed upon it in the same way as other languages might. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we have to balance that flexibility with the guidance that somebody is looking for, if they are looking for it.
Yes.
And so, that's crucial as well. Yeah.
Finally, just on that point, and to wrap up the podcast, where do you stand on accent reduction? Would you look to use your work to reduce an accent, change an accent, or what?
Well, I don't really use the term anymore. I don't think it's about reducing anything. I think it's about adding something, actually. I think you are gaining choice if you're working on pronunciation. So I see it as the person comes with with pronunciation habits. They're choosing to come to pronunciation work, and I do call it pronunciation coaching. I don't call it accent reduction because I think people are adding, they are not reducing anything. I know we could argue it's semantics, but that's how I see it anyway. But I don't believe that anybody is obliged to work on their pronunciation or their accent. I think sometimes they realize that misunderstandings are happening, so they want to know how to minimize those. But then there are other people who genuinely do want to work towards having an accent that resembles as much as possible, let's say, an accent from the southeast of England, just to take an example. Some people genuinely want this. And I work with all people from across that spectrum. And if I know that somebody's personal goal, internally motivated goal, is to work towards a particular accent framework, then I am happy to help because I don't believe in gatekeeping, because I think it can create frustration on the part of the person who wants to learn. But on the other hand, if somebody comes to me saying they want to speak clearly, then that definitely doesn't mean that they have to work on a particular accent. And it is an ongoing process. When we're working on anything, I'll say, well, this is just about clarity, or here you have a choice. If you say it this way, it will sound like this, and this way, it will sound like something else. And I want them to have the information. And sometimes certain changes, potential changes, just don't matter.
Yes.
So it's very individual, I think.
I like the fact that throughout the podcast you've spoken about choice and obviously vocal choice. Your company name is really important to you. And it does come through in your work that people have a right to use the voice they want. They shouldn't be dictated to as to how they speak. Of course, we're looking for clarity, but that doesn't take over the fact that your voice, as we said earlier, is a unique feature of your personality and therefore should be equally valued however you're speaking. Okay, let's talk about how people can make contact with you, Sonia. What's the best way people can get in touch with you?
Well, first, I suppose there's my website, vocalchoice.co.uk. And I'm also on LinkedIn. If you put in my name, Sonia Ross, Vocal Choice, you will find me. And on Instagram, I am Vocal Choice London. So that's how people can find me. The tips that we've just been talking about are on a PDF that I've created that you mentioned earlier. So that's available for download. There are more tips than the ones we've just mentioned. And that's it.
That's great, Sonia. I'll put links to definitely your LinkedIn page and if you don't mind, your Instagram page as well. Not put your email, otherwise you might get dominated by my global listeners, but people can find that through other means. And then we will also put the PDF link. And when you relaunch or when you launch the video, let me know and I will put a link to that as well. Presume it's going to go
Of
on
course.
YouTube.
And anybody who has already downloaded the PDF will get the video automatically. So
That's great.
I'll be cool with that.
So the encouragement is to go to your website. That's what the link will show you. And that's where you'll get this PDF. And therefore, as you say, you will then send them the link to the video. That's great.
Yeah, and the video will be available in a few weeks. It's coming. Okay.
Sonia, thank you very much for that. That's excellent. Thank you for going into such detail. I really appreciate your time. I'm sure my listeners will as well. Good luck with your career, obviously well developed, and good luck with your business. And I look forward to speaking with you again. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, John. Thank you for having me, and thank you for your time too. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, take care. Bye now.
Bye. Thank you.